Good morning again. Zane's out of town, so he asked me if I would take his class this morning, and told him I'd be glad to. We have been looking at the one another statements, and we've been going through them one by one. I don't have any copies of what Zane had passed out, so I hope you've got yours if you've been with us, but it doesn't really matter because we're going to be camping out on the idea of loving one another. And the next passage in that list that he had passed out begins with 1 Corinthians chapter 13, and we're going to camp there this morning, because if we're going to love one another, we need to understand what love is. We need to have a good conception of what Paul says, the inspired apostle, of what he says love is. So mark your Bibles, or put a marker or a ribbon or whatever you've got in there to mark the place at 1 Corinthians chapter 13. This is a wonderful standalone passage, and when somebody says 1 Corinthians 13, you automatically think, oh, the love chapter, right? Because that's what it is. It's all about love. And it has been a wonderful standalone passage, but we can't separate it from the larger context in which it's placed in 1 Corinthians. We know that this letter to 1 Corinthians is one where Paul deals with problem after problem after problem after problem. And while they were blessed with a whole bunch of wonderful spiritual gifts, they also had some problems with sin and some personal problems with one another. Over in chapter 1, Paul says, some of you, there's division and strife, and some of you were saying, oh, I am of Apollos, I am of Cephas, I am of Christ. You know, they were aligning themselves with different preachers or different men and saying, because I'm with this group, I'm better than you are. That's the idea behind that. Later on, you get into, say chapter 5, where they were dealing with, actually the problem was they weren't dealing with it. There was sin. Sin that Paul says is such a kind that it's not even named among the Gentiles. A man has his father's wife, and we take that to mean that she was probably his stepmother, but there was an illicit sexual relationship that was going on between this man and his stepmother. And the Corinthians were thinking, hey, aren't we pretty good for tolerating this? Look at us. We must be pretty decent folks, right? And Paul mentions the sin just briefly in verse 1, and then the whole rest of that chapter, he gives these scathing remarks about their failure to confront it, to do something about it. And the implication under all that is that this is wrecking not only your relationship with God, but your relationship with one another. Over in chapter 6, he talks about the fact that they were so set against each other that brother was taking the brother to court. There were lawsuits among one another. So there was this ripple of animosity that was going all through the church. And don't forget, this is a church, again, that was blessed with a ton of spiritual gifts. They were able to do all kinds of wonderful things. And Paul talks about them in chapter 12, again in chapter 14. But he says, even though you've got all this wonderful stuff going on, your relationships are in jeopardy. And so then he begins to talk about love. Let's read 1 Corinthians 13. Just the first three verses. 1 Corinthians 13, 1 through 3. Dino, are you there? Would you read those? Okay. Did they have tongues? Could they speak in tongues? In verse 1, Paul says, hey, what are tongues without love? What was the purpose of tongues? Of speaking in a language that you hadn't studied? Okay, so it authenticated the message, and the message was God's word, right? It was to teach, right? When we sing the songs that we sing, the psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs that Colossians 3 and Ephesians 5 remind us that we sing, we do those things not only to praise God, but for the benefit of one another, right? Now, we don't speak in tongues today. We don't have that gift of supernatural teaching that they had back then, but we still teach one another. And the point of all this teaching, just as the point of tongues was for them, was to help the hearer, was to help the recipient to strengthen their relationship with God. In verse 2, he says, if I have the gift of prophecy, could they prophesy? Well, sure they could. Paul talks about that gift later on, or actually earlier in chapter 12. They had this gift, but he says, without love, it doesn't do any good. Without love, I'm nothing. He says, if I've got faith so strong that I can do these monumental things, but I don't do it from love, it's nothing. Then he goes on to make it even more personal. If I give myself, my body, if I provide myself as the ultimate sacrifice for the cause, but it's not from love, it's nothing. Now you could look at all these things, and you could say, tongues is pretty cool. Prophecy, likewise cool. Giving yourself as a martyr for the cause, that takes guts, that takes dedication. But Paul says, without love, it means nothing. Paul is making a pretty strong point here, which comes on the heels, if you remember back in chapter 12, of the fact that they were all connected. He uses that metaphor of a body, right? Not everybody has the same function, but it all goes towards the good of the whole. And here Paul says, the reason for all that is, or rather the motivation for all that stems from love. And then we come to, I don't know what to call it, a definition of love, the characteristics of love, the traits of love. We come to this description of love in verse 4. Obviously, love is a big thing in the New Testament. When Paul wrote to the Thessalonians in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, he said, well, let's just go there instead of talking about it. Let's 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. We're probably going to look at this a little bit more later on, or maybe next week when Zane gets back. But look at 1 Thessalonians 4 and look with me in verse 9. 1 Thessalonians 4 in verse 9. Mike Vosick, you have that? Okay, so Paul says, you're supposed to love each other, and you do a really good job of it, but still do it more, right? He urges them to do more. But I like what he says in verse 9, where he says, that you have been taught by God to love one another. So how does that happen? How does God teach us to love one another? By sending His Son, right? For somebody else. For people who killed him, right? Okay. We have, you know, the statement in 1 John chapter 4, God is love, right? And so, it's weird to use this word referring to God, but He is the embodiment of love. I guess He is everything that He does, at least towards us, stems from love. So that tells us that love is more than just a mushy feeling. You know, when I was courting Cheryl, if you can call it that, and I was tripping over myself trying to get her attention, I was all, you know how you feel when you're falling in love, right? You feel all weird inside and all mushy, and stuff that you normally wouldn't have paid any attention to suddenly becomes important to you. Well, that's how we tend to base love on, is by how you feel, right? If you feel all warm and fuzzy with somebody, oh, you must be in love. And then that's part of it. You know, emotions are important. God gave us emotions. But then the longer we spent together, and the more we realized that being together 24/7 meant sometimes getting on each other's nerves 24/7. Well, love went from being kind of soft and mushy to being a deliberate action in spite of the situations that we found ourselves in. Am I making sense? Love is not just an emotion. It's part of it, but it's more than that. Love in the New Testament is a verb. It's something you do, not something you have. Love is what you direct towards another person. Anybody know the three general Greek words for love? that mostly is referred to when somebody talks about love. I mean, the New Testament was written in Greek, and so those Greek words mean something, and the Greeks were very descriptive in the definitions that they poured into their words. One Greek word for, go ahead, Mike. Agape. Okay. That's the New Testament one. We're going to come to that one in just a second because it's so special. Allie? Pardon me? Phileo. It's part of, yeah. Phileo is, Philadelphia, right? The city of brotherly love, right? And that's what it is. It's this affection that makes for great friendships. That's what phileo is. There's another word that is never mentioned in the New Testament, but it's a Greek word. It's eros, right? You've heard of erotica, like that. Eros is the word that the Greeks had for sexual love. It's got a very specific meaning. Another word that you only find in the New Testament in the negative sense is the Greek word storge. Now you find it as astorge, which means without storge. Storge means natural affection, like a parent would have for a child, or a child should have for a parent. And Paul says in a couple of places there are people who don't have this kind of love for their parents. They're without natural affection. And then we come to what Mike mentioned, agape, which is the love that's used as an example over and over and over again of not only the love God has for us, but the love we have for one another. What, Mike, you brought it up. I'm going to pick on you. What separates, what makes agape stand out from all the other types of love? The part about agape love is that it always seeks the highest benefit to its recipient. It puts self on the back burner and always seeks to better the one to whom that love is directed toward. And the reason I say that is because I want you to keep that in mind as we go through verses 4 through 7, which we're going to spend some time on. Paul mentions 7 things that love is or does, and 8 things that love is not or does not. And so we're going to talk about each one of those things because they're important. Let's have someone read verses 4 through 7. Some of the things that it says love is, and it hits us right at the beginning, is love is patient, love is kind, right? So if love is patient, how is love patient? Okay. And that's really the definition of this patience. It's an endurance. Like Cheryl says, long suffering. So to whom is love patient towards or long suffering towards? Okay. Right off the bat, we're challenged. Right off the bat, we're challenged to not retaliate, but to give something where it isn't earned. Right? Yeah. Love is work. Love is hard work. Right? Or at least loving like the Bible tells us to is hard work. Love is kind, it says. So how is love kind? If you tie that to what Cheryl said before about love being long-suffering or forbearing, how would love be kind on the heels of that? Okay. When we get frustrated with someone, what are we often tempted to do? How are we tempted to react? Okay. It's hard to deal with frustration because you've lost your patience, right? But it tells us that because love is patient, love is kind. My mom used to tell me, when you start to lose your cool, stop, count to 10. Not because she wanted me to remember my math, but because it would get me to take a breath, to stop for a minute and think. And I can't tell you how many arguments I would have averted in my life if I would have just stopped, counted to 10, and thought about what was going to come out of my pie hole the next minute, about what I was going to say. If I would have just stopped and thought, maybe I would have been a lot kinder. He goes on to tell us that love is patient, love is kind. It's not jealous. You know, the Bible talks about God as being a jealous God, right? So when we think of jealousy, what do we think of? Okay, envy, right? That's really envy. So why would it be a positive trait in God and a negative trait for humans? Okay. It's appropriate, right? It's right. God wants what's rightfully His, and He has every right to say, if you don't give me what's rightfully mine, I'm a jealous God. I want what's mine. You shouldn't give, the relationship that a man and a wife have together, you have this mutual relationship where you give to one another and no one else that which only belongs in that relationship, right? And God is like that. You have something that is rightfully mine and I want that. And when you give it to someone else, I'm a jealous God. But that's not what he's talking about here. Paul is talking about wanting something, like Lowell said, that belongs to others. And it's not just wanting something that belongs to others. It's wanting it and depriving them of having it so that you can have it. It's something stronger than just saying, ooh, they got a nice car. I'm jealous. No, it's their car should be mine. There's more to it than that. And you can see how this idea of wanting the best for others is already starting to come out. Paul goes on. And he says, well, we're talking about, let's go back. Let's start with the positive first. I should have done that before. Before we start talking about what love is not or does not, let's keep talking about what love is or what love does. We already know love is patient. Love is kind. Look at verse 6. It says, love rejoices with the truth. Now, how does love do that? Is love a person that says, woohoo, the truth is being taught? Okay? So truth is good, right? And love is positive. So it makes sense that something positive, love, would rejoice with what is good, the truth. You remember when you read through the beginning chapters of Proverbs, it's all about wisdom, right? It kind of personifies wisdom as a woman who calls out and says, okay, all you naive ones, turn in here. Let me tell you what's right, what's good, what's true, right? And then it goes on to castigate those it calls fools who reject wisdom, who reject truth. Truth is what has been given to us to separate us from all that is wrong and bad and evil. Remember what Jesus said in his prayer in John chapter 17 as he prayed to his Father? Sanctify them in the truth. Your word is truth. So there's more going on here than just general truth. There's a very specific kind of truth that love rejoices in. Verse 7. Look at these three things. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. What does it mean that love bears all things? Okay, you said the key word or the key phrase, with others. Everybody hear what Dan said? This kind of love, there's a lot of things that you have to overlook with others. And that's what this is all about. It's about relationship, right? That's what Paul is talking about. You've got some messed up relationships because they lack love. We've been talking about, in other places, we looked at Ephesians 4, Colossians 4, about how we need to, actually Colossians 3 verses 12 through 14, I think, where we're told that we need to be able to put up with one another. And Paul tells us here, this is why. Because this is what love does. Love bears all things. Look with me at 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 for a second. 1 Thessalonians 5. Let's read verse 14. 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 14. Zach, are you there? Okay. Now we look at passages like encourage or phrases like encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak, be patient with everyone. That sounds a lot like bearing with all things. But what about admonishing the unruly? That doesn't sound very positive. But could it be? Look. Say what? Admonish the idle. Okay. So he's talking specifically about teenagers, right? No, I'm kidding. No. I mean, look at us. Look at the makeup of this local church, right? There are people here who have been Christians far longer than I have been, and some who are much more recent, and maybe some who aren't yet, right? So we've got all these different levels of learning, all these different personalities, a makeup of diversity and variation, and yet it all meshes together in this. I'm looking for a word and it's escaped me. In this mix-up of, I don't even like that word because it makes it sound like an accident. In this coming together of people with a purpose, right? And that's part of what I think Paul is talking about when he says that love bears all things. You know, we put up with a lot with one another. You put up with a lot with me. I know for a fact I am not everybody's cup of tea. I know that. I get it. I've got sometimes a personality that grates on other people. I'm not anybody's idea of the best preacher in the world. I know that I'm not everybody's cup of tea. And yet I'm shown grace and kindness by so many. Now, that's just one individual. Think about all of us. It takes that for us to be able to do what we do and still hold to our common purpose, right? When I worked at the cat dealership in Albuquerque before I quit to preach full time, sometimes I'd be given special projects by my boss and I'd do it, and sometimes the first couple times wouldn't work, you know, and someone else would say, well, maybe if you did it this way, you know. That's the same as saying, you're doing that wrong, but it's a better way to say it, right? Maybe if you did things this way. And helpful advice like that works, right? I think that's part of what's behind admonishment. I think you're right. Okay, it's criticism, but it's constructive criticism, right? Okay. And that's the difference between constructive and destructive criticism. Paul goes on to say there in verse 7, that it believes all things. What does that mean? It means that we're gullible and we're taken in by what anybody says. What does it mean to believe all things? How does that work out in relationships, though? In horizontal relationships? Can you say it a little louder? They didn't hear you. But that's... we're willing to give each other the benefit of the doubt, right? I mean, God has given us a lot of leeway in personal relationships where not everything is wrong, maybe just not the way you do it. Okay, and that goes along with, what does James tell us? Be quick to hear and slow to speak, right? Sometimes we have it the other way around. In fact, especially when we are in a tense situation and words are being exchanged, usually we're thinking about how we're going to respond to what's said instead of listening to what's said, right? Okay. Sometimes, yeah, you're right. We've got to, behind all of this, I think, is keeping our, making sure we understand that the purpose we serve is bigger than all of us. He says in verse 7, not only it bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things. Love is forward-looking. Love looks to the future. Love never gives up. Love believes that eventually things are going to work out. Whatever relationship problems that you and I might have, in the big scheme of things, they're going to be resolved. Hopefully. That's what love hopes, right? That things are going to work out. What I think that tells me, and maybe I'm wrong, you can tell me if you think I am or not, It tells me when it says that love hopes all things, that love is confident. Right? That's what hope is. Hope is confidence in something better. And then finally he says, it endures all things. Love never gives up. And I think that's, we've already made the point that it's long-suffering, it's forbearing, it's patient, but for how long? As long as it takes, right? Love doesn't give up. It endures all things. Comments or questions on the positive traits of love that Paul has been talking to us about? I like what you said because it reminds us that we can have a more excellent way here. That there's a way we can live here with each other that transcends our disagreements, that transcends our different personalities, that transcends our personality conflicts, that transcends all the different ideas and the diversity that we have. It truly is unity and diversity. Love makes that possible. And then he says that there are some things that love doesn't, or rather love is not. Jealousy is one of those. Love is not jealous. But look again at verse 4. At the end of that verse in the New American Standard, it says, love is not arrogant. Now, did the Corinthians have a problem with that? Yeah, they did. I'm of Paul. I'm of Cephas. I'm of Christ. I'm of Apollos. Right? I'm better than you. And yet Jesus taught his disciples time and time and time and time again, and us by extension, that really what we're after is humility, right? Remember when the disciples came to Jesus and said, hey, you know, when you come in your kingdom, we want to be set up on, you know, we want to be at your, on either side of you, at your right hand and your left hand. We want to be right there with you up on the top, right? Jesus says, I don't know why. In my mind's eye, I always see him shaking his head. He says, you don't know what you're asking. You know, and they didn't. And then Jesus goes on to tell them that really it's the one who is debased that's going to be exalted. It's the servant that's going to be up high. And that's hard because that's not the, I know we don't live in the same culture that they did, but this need to be on top just goes along with man no matter what era or culture or age he lives in. And especially us, right? In America, we don't like to be on bottom. We don't like to be humble. And we would like to think ourselves as better than others. What do you think 95% of the fights on Facebook are all about? It's about one-upmanship. About people trying to put themselves on top. But Paul says that if you embody love, then that's not who you are. In fact, we're not going to have time to finish this. I understand that. But I want to think about this for a moment. Somebody smarter than me has said that a wonderful exercise is to insert your name wherever you see love in this passage. And it's a humbling thing. If you've never done it, do it now. Could I say, Zeke is patient. Zeke is kind. Zeke is not jealous. Zeke does not brag, and Zeke is not arrogant. Zeke does not act unbecomingly, and Zeke does not seek his own. Zeke is not provoked, and Zeke does not take into account the wrong suffered. Zeke does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but Zeke rejoices with the truth. Zeke bears all things. Zeke believes all things. Zeke hopes all things, and Zeke endures all things. I can't say that. And I doubt if any of the Corinthians could. And I doubt if any of you could 100%. Maybe you can. But I know this, that because it's there, there's hope. That because it's there, there's opportunity. And it doesn't come without reliance on the Lord. Comments? Yeah. That's what sanctification is, right? It's an upward climb, and it's always upward, and it's a confident one. I really thought I was going to get through this, but those are famous last words. I'll let Zane know where we left off, or maybe Tracy, you could and Zane can decide if he wants to go on with this or go on to the next passage. But thanks for your comments. I appreciate it.